This is Radio Boston. I'm Jill Kaufman.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Under cross-examination today in a Concord, New Hampshire courtroom, a 16-year-old girl sobbed as she said, "I was raped. I was violated in so many ways." The girl has accused a former fellow student, 19-year-old Owen LaBrie, of sexually assaulting her while at the elite St. Paul's Prep School.
The alleged attack took place just days from graduation last year as part of a campus ritual that's called Senior Salute, where senior boys reportedly seek out sexual encounters with younger students. Prosecutors are focusing on what they call a disturbing culture at the school, while defense attorneys say the encounter was consensual. They're highlighting seemingly flirtatious emails sent between LaBrie and the girl before and after the incident.
Above all, the case forces all of us to take an honest, unflinching look at school tradition, teens, and sexual assault. And listeners, I'm wondering what you make of this case. Did you go to an elite prep school like St. Paul's? What was the culture like there? When you hear of traditions such as Senior Salute, where senior boys seek out allegedly sexual encounters with younger students, what's your reaction to that? Is this a problem unique to elite schools, or is it an issue in every American high school? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. Lots of questions to ask, and we'll do so starting with Nancy Gertner, retired federal judge and current professor at Harvard Law School. Nancy, welcome back to the show.
Good to be here.
So, Nancy, you take a very interesting perspective here because you've actually sort of been on both sides of this issue before, bringing cases on behalf of women who've been assaulted and also trying cases on behalf of those who had been accused. So what's your reaction, first of all, that this case has even made it to court?
Well, 10, 15 years ago, it would not have made it to court, and that would have been a tragedy. In other words, 10 or 15 years ago, the fact that the young woman did not immediately complain to anyone, what we used to call fresh complaint, the fact that there were even ambiguous emails before and after would have led a prosecutor to say, "I'm not going to bother." The change over the past 20 years has been that we recognize that a woman can be raped and not immediately go to the police or not immediately go to a hospital, that in fact trauma will enable her to do that, will make it possible that she won't do that, or she may well not even express her lack of consent, or she may well even be ambiguous in her comments afterwards, that all of that is consistent with assault, but it is also consistent with consent. In other words, the difference between 15, 20 years ago is that now this is a case that will be tried in a court of law where both sides will be presented. 20 years ago, a prosecutor would have simply said, "I'm not going to go forward with this." Yeah. But the jury will be told given that look at the emails, and they either connote no crime happened or they connote a crime happened and she was traumatized. It could go either way.
Now, what do you make of the fact that prosecutors do seem to be taking care or special care to describe, you know, what this tradition, this senior salute tradition, and they say it's an important part of the context of this case. Do you agree?
Well, I think it actually is a two-edged sword. On the one hand, it suggests that the defendant was looking to score, and he claims that there was no sexual intercourse that took place. And so, to some degree, the context makes more probable, they could argue, that this was actually going to be a conquest in the traditional way. I actually think it is a two-edged sword, but it's a little hard to evaluate from afar, which is to say, when she accepted the invitation, what was the significance of that? In other words, talking about the culture makes problematic, it seems to me, both his conduct and her conduct.
Interesting. Well, we should say that while the accuser is 16 years old now, she was 15 years old at the time, and the defendant, Owen LaBrie, was 18. So can you just briefly describe to us why this isn't automatically a statutory rape case?
New Hampshire has what was called a Romeo and Juliet law. In other words, statutory rape in general is rape of a child under a certain age, typically 16. In many states, that simply any kind of even consensual encounter with a child under 16 is rape. New Hampshire has a requirement where not only at her age, but also the difference in her age and his age matters. So there has to be at least a 4 or sometimes 5 year difference between the alleged victim and the defendant for it to qualify. In this situation, she was 15, but he was 18. So under their law, this was a change in the law a couple of years ago in order to deal with essentially sexual encounters between people close enough in age that the theory was that this should not be seen as statutory rape.
Right. So today in the courtroom, the defense attorney for Owen LaBrie, J.W. Carney, who we should note also defended James Whitey Bulger, he did cross-examine the accuser and spent quite a bit of time going through emails that were sent between her and LaBrie, both before, as you mentioned, and after the alleged incident. And basically, you know, some of them seem flirtatious. The language wasn't necessarily accusatory at all. I mean, it seems as if his goal is to prove that the encounter was consensual. But how do messages sent before or after an incident prove consent at all?
Well, they provide a context. If you invited someone, someone says, you know, enters into a relationship with someone or is about an encounter with someone, and the email suggests that she knew what was going to happen. That's one thing. And then the question is, even though, let me roll this back a bit, even though after an assault, it is no longer the case that someone has to be indignant and scream to the police in order to justify our belief that this was not consensual, the opposite is not true, which is to say that if she describes it in a affirmative way, if she describes it in a way that suggests nothing happened or that she was happy with what happened, that bears on what had happened only minutes before. It's not unusual in a criminal case, for example, to see evidence of the relationship before the alleged crime and evidence of the relationship after the alleged crime. But again, as I said, it's a two-edged sword. The explanation for her behavior through these emails, as we understand it, is that she was embarrassed and she didn't want to rock the boat close to graduation, believed that she was raped, but nevertheless didn't want to rock the boat so close to graduation. The other side is it suggests there was no boat to rock. It could go in either direction.
Nancy Gertner is a former Massachusetts federal judge and current professor at Harvard Law School. Nancy, thanks so much as always.
Thank you.
We're talking about the case in Concord, New Hampshire of defendant, 19-year-old, I should say, Owen LaBrie, who has been accused of sexually assaulting a younger student at the elite St. Paul's Prep School, and the questions that raises about school traditions, teens, and sexual assault. And we want to hear from you. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Are you surprised or maybe not that certain traditions, such as one call at St. Paul's called Senior Salute, even exist? What does it mean to you that a case like this can emerge from a prep school like St. Paul's? And what's your reaction overall to how teens think about or communicate or talk about sex and sexual assault? Call us again at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Now, I should say that someone named Shamus Khan, who's an alumnus of St. Paul's School, wrote in a 2011 book called Privilege, The Making of an Adolescent Elite at St. Paul's School. He wrote about rituals there and that he says were used to mainly impose hierarchy, and that some of them have taken on a pointedly sexual term. He wrote that there's an annual dance called Screw when, quote, the sexual desirability of girls is determined by their value on the marketplace, the screw marketplace. And he writes that there was a common denominator of sex and sexuality as the pathway to belonging and welcoming for girls. So with that in mind, let's turn to Abigail Jones. She's a senior writer at Newsweek and co-author of Restless Virgins, Love, Sex, and Survival in Prep School, which detailed the real-life story of a group of seniors at Milton Academy in Milton, Massachusetts. Abigail Jones, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us is Sarah Miller, doctoral candidate in sociology at UMass Amherst and former director of education and training at Rape Victims Advocates in Chicago. Sarah, welcome to you.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, Abigail, I read that that excerpt from Shams Khan's 2011 book. You wrote about Milton. I mean, let me just first ask the most simple question. Is this unique to prep schools? Is there a culture in prep schools that people are just now getting their heads around?
I don't think that teenagers having sex is unique to prep schools. Absolutely not. I think that...
Well, not that so much, but sort of the traditions that center, define traditions
right, right.
that center around sex.
Sure. You know, I think that to a certain degree, like sex and these types of traditions, whatever they may be, are at high schools everywhere, large and small, private and public. I do think that elite prep schools make better headlines. There's the entitlement, power, money, the token paragraph that we've read in every single article about the St. Paul's story, about the prominent senators or presidents or CEOs that have gone to the schools. But I think that the prep schools offer an interesting microcosm and an entry point for us to talk about what is really going on in the culture of sex and social interaction among girls and boys today.
Hmm.
I don't think it's that different from what happened 10 years ago with the scandal at Milton Academy, nor is it particularly different from what happened any decade before that.
Hmm.
The culture in which these events are happening is what's changed.
Well, so tell me more about that.
So just to put all the facts on the table, in the mid-2000s, Milton made national headlines when a 15-year-old girl performed oral sex on 5 varsity hockey players in the locker room on school grounds. The news broke about this. The 5 boys were expelled. They were charged with statutory rape, and they agreed to serve pretrial probation. The girl left the school. The story was explosive, in part because it happened at, like St. Paul's, an elite prep school, but partly because the behavior for many people was so shocking. I wrote a nonfiction book with my co-author Marissa Miley, Restless Virgins, about the social and sexual lives of students during the year of this incident. And we used Milton as a microcosm for what drives young people to have extreme and often casual sexual encounters. So 10 years ago, we uncovered a culture at Milton where, for some students, hooking up was a form of social currency. Oral sex, for example, for some students was very casual, almost like a handshake. There were examples of group sex acts. And the anecdote that came up numerous times that has stuck with me ever since is this concept that one young man said to me, stories make the man and the man gets all the stories.
Well, if I may just jump in here, because that's a really interesting point. I want to bring Sarah Miller into this conversation. I mean, what's your reaction to that about what Abigail Jones said, that for years now, it seems as if, again, that it's those stories of the encounters that seem to be very powerful motivators.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I did a study with a bunch of different women. I interviewed women that went to 51 different high schools around the country about their experiences, specifically with slut shaming. And so often those stories also overlapped with the kinds of stories that Abigail was talking about, these really scandalous types of stories about girls having, quote, trains run on them or, you know, giving lots of either oral sex or other types of sex to all the players of this team or that team or whatever. And then, of course, the more mundane kinds of slut stories that girls would tell, just about, you know, a girl cheating on, you know, their boyfriend or, you know, you name it. There's a wide variety of them. But, you know, what's underlying all of these kinds of things is the notion that, you know, girls don't have the same access to making claims about their sexuality positively that boys do. Right. So boys in America largely learn that, you know, they're supposed to be sexual. They're supposed to be heterosexual, but they're also supposed to be sexual. This is the learning that they're receiving in most American high schools. Girls aren't necessarily receiving the same thing. So, you know, this case involves the privilege of visibility. It's extremely frustrating that cases like this one get national media coverage, while many cases of sexual assault that exist at non-elite high schools all over America largely don't. But what's useful about this visibility is it's turning our attention to the culture of schools themselves,
right.
And how they can often unwittingly reinforce these gender inequities and promote rape culture. So,
can I just jump in there, because I want to turn a question back to Abigail Jones exactly on this point, because It seems as if the school's rector, St. Paul's school's rector, Mike Hirschfeld, he wrote a letter last summer to the school community, specifically to parents. And in it, he wrote, "Whatever further developments become known in this case, a serious breach of our standards of mutual trust and respect has occurred. I'm determined to learn if this alleged violation is an aberration or represents a broader issue that our many school-wide conversations about a healthy community have not sufficiently addressed," end quote. That's from Mike Hirschfeld, the rector at St. Paul's. What I take from that is, can we truly believe that schools don't know this kind of thing is going on, whether it's sort of the consensual encounters or even more as part of school culture?
I can only offer you my personal opinion. I haven't interviewed the heads of schools with that exact question, but I think it would be very surprising to me for schools truly not to know this is going on. I just think that, especially today in 2015, where teenagers are coming of age in a culture that is absolutely saturated in sexualization, from social media to the TV shows they watch to pop culture, everything. It's just, the St. Paul's trial is absolutely, it is extremely upsetting, but what occurred is not necessarily surprising. The culture is not surprising. And it would surprise me if there were leaders of schools who had no idea this was going on.
Well, let's take a couple calls here. Christopher is calling from East Boston. You're on the air, Christopher.
Hi. I went to a boarding school in central Massachusetts. And our school didn't have a lot of these traditions. It had been co-educational for a while. But we definitely played against teams like St. Paul's and other elite schools. I think one of the issues is, even in this conversation that we're having, using the word elite helps promote the concept that is really the root of the problem. These kids, particularly young boys, have been raised in an environment where they are above society. They come from wealthy families where the parents are privileged and they are privileged. And I do believe that is at the root of the issue of them feeling as though these are things that they can do and without any ramifications.
Thank you so much. I'm going to just jump in here because I think you make a very interesting and important point, and I appreciate your call. Because there was a moment in the courtroom in Concord over the past couple of days that's really stuck with me. And we have some tape of the accuser on the stand, the 16-year-old accuser. She was asked by prosecutor Catherine Ruffle how she was processing what had happened to her after the alleged assault. So here's the 16-year-old accuser and what she was telling herself.
I was telling myself, okay, that was the right thing to do. You were being respectful. You let him do what he wanted to do. That's okay. Okay, you didn't bother him. That's fine. Okay.
So a little tough to hear that courtroom sound, but the accuser said on the stand that she was telling herself she was being respectful, that she let him do what he wanted to do. That's okay. You didn't bother him. That's fine. Sarah Miller, I have to just say, I was a little taken aback by that. Not that I disbelieve her or I'm passing any judgment on the guilt or innocence of the defendant, but that a young woman, young girl, a 16-year-old could say that allowing someone to do what they wanted to her was a sign of respect or showing respect.
I mean, I think it's actually incredibly common. So girls often don't learn that, they can say yes to sex just as much as they can say no to sex, right? Girls learn over and over again that no means no, right? But, the notion that, a girl can, when a girl is involved in a sexually violent situation, she's doing whatever she can to get through the experience and to make sense of it for herself, to be able to survive that and make sense of it for herself. She's doing whatever she can and drawing from whatever cultural repertoire she's got about sexuality in general and about, how to, just get by and get to the next step. So, for her to be talking about that she's being respectful, she's also saying she's trying not to upset this guy more. But it's also, you know, girls learn that, you know, their sexuality is not necessarily, you know, something that's driven from their desire. They're learning that sexuality is driven from boys' desire. And that's a really problematic message that American teenagers often learn in schools, and certainly not just elite schools. You know, we're missing a really big key moment in sex education in a lot of schools in this country, where we actually challenge these traditional gender norms, where girls and boys learn that the sexual double standard is a normative part of girls and boys' sexuality, and that there's nothing you can do about it. I've heard so many girls over and over again in interviews talk about how, like, this is just the way it is. This is just how it is, you know. Like, I get that it's not fair that I get judged when, you know, something either bad happens to me or when I've engaged in sex consensually. I get that, you know, it's not fair that I'm the one that gets judged, but that's just the way that it is.
Right. Well,
and we need to counter that narrative.
So Abigail Jones, I mean, you've taken a look at schools. I mean, what more can schools do? I mean, the St. Paul's rector said that they've had school-wide conversations about healthy community, that there's, you know, there's educational programs that go on, of course, not in just St. Paul's, but virtually every American high school. What more could they do?
Yeah, I just, before I answer that, I just want to say I think what Sarah just said is incredibly important. I've heard the same thing from tween girls and teen girls about this kind of social currency, self-worth, and the enduring power of a popular older guy showing interest in you. And it is public schools and it is private schools. And the question of what do we do, I think, extends beyond the school. It extends to parents, to educators, to teachers, and to teenagers themselves. Because, you know, what's going on at St. Paul's right now is happening within a larger cultural moment of rape accusations against Bill Cosby. There are over 100 colleges and universities being investigated for mishandling sex assault cases. And according to the CDC, nearly half of women who've been raped in their lifetime experienced their first rape before the age of 18. Mm-hmm. 35% of women raped as minors were also raped as adults. These are very terrifying numbers. And I think the first thing we can do is to step outside the prep school framework, which I think does exist, absolutely. But this is going on everywhere. And also, recognize that this sexualization starts really early. Last year, I worked on an investigative piece at Newsweek about the sexualization of tween girls. These are 8, 9, and 10-year-old girls who, as I said before, are very aware that they are growing up in a culture that is selling their own sexualization to them. So to wait until people are 16, 17 years old, in a way, it's too late. The conversations need to shift from how to stay safe to how to understand your emotions, how to make smart decisions, and what does smart mean to you? As Sarah said, saying yes to sex for a young woman is just as important to learning how to say no and empowering herself either way. And then, of course, parents as gatekeepers.
Right. And let alone the additional messages that can and should be sent to young men as well. Abigail Jones is senior writer at Newsweek and co-author of Restless Virgins, Love, Sex, and Survival in Prep School. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Sarah Miller, doctoral candidate in sociology at UMass Amherst and former director of education and training at Rape Victim Advocates in Chicago. Sarah, thank you for being on the show as well.
Thanks so much.
Listeners, there's more of the show in just a minute. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Jill Kaufman. This is Radio Boston.